So I've wanted to have this event ever since I read two books together over a year ago. Those two books were the autobiography of Malcolm X and Joseph Smith, Rough Stone Rolling, by Richard Bushman of Columbia. I was startled by how similar these two men were in their leadership goals and in the solutions they saw to the problems of their peoples. In his autobiography, Malcolm X explained that permanent and worthwhile solutions to black problems would come from within the black community, not from without. Joseph Smith's leadership from within the Mormon Church is similar in some important respects. Although Mormons, as a minority, have not had it anywhere near as tough as African Americans, our interaction with the government and with the American majority has not always been as peaceful as it is today. Mormons were driven from state to state. Their homes and businesses were burned by mobs. Leaders of the church were tarred, feathered, and occasionally murdered. The governor of Missouri signed an order to either drive the Mormons out of that state or exterminate them. After the Mormons had settled in Utah in the 1840s and 50s, federal troops marched across the plains to put down what President Johnson had heard was a Mormon uprising. And in response, Mormon settlers were on guard, ready to flee and torch their homes and possessions. But in isolation, Mormons got good at solving their own problems. Brigham Young, when colonizing the West, organized all of the industries the church members would need to support themselves, at least in the short term. Social problems, disputes, and business concerns were all addressed by the church, occasionally to the chagrin of federally appointed territorial officials. Because the Mormons were a smaller group and could more easily relocate, Joseph Smith and Brigham Young got to do for Mormons something akin to what Malcolm X wanted for African Americans, to develop an independent community that could solve the problems of its members. African Americans have done what is probably the harder thing, which is to address their own problems and strengthen their cultural identity without the luxury of isolation and in the face of great opposition from the American majority. I hope this event will help us understand how these two American minorities have fared at accepting each other. The history of the Mormon Church, like any other church in the United States, and it has a good parts and bad parts when it comes to acceptance of African Americans. There have been black members of the church since very near the beginning. The church was not immune from the problems of race in the society from which its early converts came. Other churches from that time, which was around 1830, began to have segregated seating and eventually separate black churches. That solution, if you can even call it that, to the race problem was simply unavailable to the Mormons. In early Mormon communities, and this is still the rule today, where you go to church is determined by a boundary system. Which congregation you attend depends on where you live, not where you'd rather go. And so the natural birds of a feather gravitation toward having separate black and white congregations couldn't happen within the Mormon framework. Some early church leaders had relatively progressive views about African Americans for their era. Joseph Smith didn't buy the cultural or genetically inferior stereotypes about African Americans and saw blacks as equal participants in God's plan for exalting his children. Said he, "Change their position with the whites and they would be like them. They are the subjects of salvation. Go into Cincinnati or any city and find an educated Negro who rides in his carriage and you will see a man who has risen by the powers of his own mind to his exalted state of respectability. The slaves in Washington are more refined than many in high places, and the black boys will take the shine off many of those they brush and wait on." Close quote. In fact, one of the reasons the Mormons were unpopular in Missouri is that they were seen by some as abolitionist northerners invading the state. When Joseph Smith ran for president in 1844, U.S. president that is, one of his proposals was to end slavery in the South by selling off federal lands in the West to compensate southern slaveholders. Now, that's probably not the most attractive moral option since it would reinforce the concept that people could be paid for. But after the bloody Civil War, many praised the practicality of Smith's proposal for putting an end to slavery. Now, all that said, there is one big issue that drives most current discussions of race and Mormonism, although I'm afraid it sometimes obscures the complete story on race relations in the church. Although the church didn't have segregated seating or separate congregations, there was still some segregation in the church. Many leadership priesthood positions in the church are held exclusively by men who have been ordained to the priesthood, and holding the priesthood is part of an individual's progress toward an exalted life with God in heaven. For many years after the church settled in Utah, as a matter of practice, black men were not ordained to the priesthood. This practice became solidified during the presidency of Brigham Young and lasted until 1978, when Spencer W. Kimball, then the prophet and president of the church, received a revelation that the priesthood should be given to all worthy males. In other words, Race was no longer a factor, but the individual still had to live according to the commandments and standards of the church. President Kimball and others have compared this event to St. Peter's vision, in which he was told that the gospel was to go not only to the Jews, but to the Gentiles as well. This was a wonderful day for all Mormons, black and otherwise. So, how do Mormons today deal with the priesthood ban? There are a host of different responses. Generally, you can sort them into three groups. Those who believe the ban was the will of God, but don't think it was inherently racist. Those who don't think it was the will of God. And those who are agnostic on the point. Frankly, I should add a fourth category. Since the 1978 revelation came before many members of the church and pretty much everybody in RELS were born, a lot of people just don't think about it that much because it's not really a part of life as a Mormon today. The church today is a worldwide faith, operating in different countries and cultures. Leaders of the church speak very clearly against racism. Gordon B. Hinckley, who was the president of the church until his recent passing, said this in a conference of priesthood holders in April of 2006. Quote, "We all rejoiced in the 1978 revelation given President Kimball. I was there in the temple at the time that that happened. There was no doubt in my mind, or in the minds of my associates, that what was revealed was the mind and the will of the Lord. No man who makes disparaging remarks concerning those of another race can consider himself a true disciple of Christ, nor can he consider himself to be in harmony with the teachings of the Church of Christ. How can any man holding the priesthood arrogantly assume that he is eligible for the priesthood, whereas another who lives a righteous life, but whose skin is of a different color, is ineligible? If any within the sound of my voice is inclined to indulge in this, then let him go before the Lord and ask for forgiveness." Close quote. So you might wonder why we're hosting this event. If the priesthood ban is in the past, why on earth would we bring it up and possibly offend some of our friends by talking about unflattering aspects of the church's past? And why would Balsa co-sponsor this event with us? When Malcolm X, towards the end of his life, made a pilgrimage to Mecca, he stayed in a crowded room with Muslim pilgrims from all over the world and of all races. Malcolm X had little tolerance for the white man in America, but during this pilgrimage he learned that it was the circumstances unique to America that created racism, and a true brotherhood of all races could exist. He described the pilgrims in this way. "They were of all complexions. The whole atmosphere was of warmth and friendliness. The feeling hit me that there really wasn't any color problem here. The effect was as though I had just stepped out of a prison." Close quote. That description touched me. But I realize that much remains to be done in America before that brotherhood is a reality. And that kind of healing can only be achieved through an honest discussion. To borrow again from Malcolm X, "Despite my firm convictions, I have always been a man who tries to face facts and to accept the reality of life as new experience and new knowledge unfolds it." Close quote. To achieve that kind of friendship and brotherhood, we have to face facts, even the ones that are hard to explain. In the end, the challenge of American society has been getting the majority to accept the minorities. Perhaps, through this discussion and others like it, two minorities can show them how it's done. Our speaker tonight is Winston Wilkinson. Mr. Wilkinson was appointed by President George W. Bush on December 19, 2005, to serve as director of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Office for Civil Rights. In this capacity, Mr. Wilkinson provides overall leadership of OCR's mission to promote and ensure that individuals have equal access and opportunity in all HHS-funded programs and services without facing unlawful discrimination. OCR also has responsibility for implementing and enforcing the HIPAA privacy rule. A major goal of the rule is to ensure that individuals' health information is properly protected while allowing the flow of health information needed to provide and promote high-quality health care and protect the public's health and well-being. Mr. Wilkinson has more than 35 years of public and private sector experience in civil rights and public policy, and has held a number of senior positions in the federal government. Prior to being appointed OCR director, he served as chief executive officer of Winston Wilkinson & Associates, a firm providing strategic consulting services to clients primarily focused on local, state, and federal issues. Mr. Wilkinson previously served as an elected member of the Salt Lake County Council. He also served as in-house legal counsel to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. He was involved in the civil rights movement of the 1960s and 70s. He began his public service by joining the United States Navy in 1962 and served his country for 4 years. In 1981, he joined the U.S. Department of Education as a political appointee and served until 1988 as a senior official. While at the Department of Education, Mr. Wilkinson served as special assistant in the Office of Civil Rights, Office of Rehabilitation Services, and Office of the Secretary. In 1988, he moved to HHS to serve as Deputy Director in the Office for Civil Rights. Mr. Wilkinson received a bachelor's degree in business administration from Morgan State University in 1971 and completed his Juris Doctorate at Howard University Law School in 1974. He and his wife, Gloria, have 4 children and 8 grandchildren. Please join me in giving Director Wilkinson a warm welcome to Virginia.
Well, good evening. I need to do some housekeeping. I normally put my handkerchief here. I sweat because I take medicine that gives me hot flashes. So if I'm sweating, not because I'm nervous, but because of the hot flashes. I also want to introduce my special assistant, Oldies Williams. Oldies has been with me for about 2 years, and for all who's interested, Oldies is single and a lawyer. So, but I wanted to thank William for that that kind introduction, and on the background of the church. It's truly a pleasure for me to be with you this evening. I'd also thank the Black Law School Association for co-sponsoring this event. I was especially intrigued by Bill's introductory remarks with the reference to the similarity of the historical struggle of the Mormon church and the African-American community. Very interesting. He also got my attention when he spoke of the similarities in leadership goals and problem-solving techniques between Malcolm X and Joseph Smith. Very intriguing. Never heard that before. Now, in my youthful days, which I will discuss later, I read a lot about Malcolm X. And I think Bill might be onto something there, but I won't go into it tonight, Bill, but I think you're really onto something. There might be there are similarities between Malcolm and Malcolm's views and the LDS Church, which actually helped guided me to join the church, those values and those principles that they both shared. But I thought Bill did an excellent job in summarizing the church's history and really why this event is being hosted tonight. Now, I understand that the Rex E. Lee Society and BALSA had a number of gospel-centered discussions. Is that true? Oh, just you and Ellen had discussions.
Not officially, just I think people have talked about these issues a little bit on their own. I haven't.
Oh, okay. Well, I understood that might have been some discussions going there. But I believe my role here tonight is to give you my thoughts and my perspective on this issue from an African-American member of the church. Now, in May, I received this email from Bill asking if I would be interested in speaking at this event that's co-sponsored by BALSA. And the subject of the speech would be Mormonism and race. And I told my family, my kids, this, and they said, I think you've been set up. But so it's a very intriguing subject. Now, hopefully I'm not being set up, but I got nervous because, you know, it said it was being co-sponsored by BALSA. And when I was in law school, BALSA was a very radical organization. Just joking. I'm just joking. No, I had a great relationship with BALSA. But I guess based on the discussion I thought you might have with Bill, I know you're curious about how an African-American could have joined the Mormon church. But for me, whenever I get in conversation with African-Americans and they discover that I'm from Utah, a Mormon, a Republican, they look at me and say, "This brother's lost his way. Forgot who he is." But no, I really haven't lost my way. But you know, hopefully, like Bill said, we can have an honest discussion of churches, of races. You know, what I want to do tonight is talk more about me and about how I found my way. You know, a professional African American. Into the Mormon church that Bill discussed earlier. I became a member about 27 years ago. The invitation to speak intrigued me because this year was the 30th anniversary of the celebration of the church's ban on blacks holding the priesthood. So we had some great events in Utah over the summer, and they were very well attended. They were very well covered. So there was some discussion about blacks, and this was, so 1978, it's been 30 years since black blacks were able to hold a priesthood. Now, there's a lot of history, a lot of writings on this issue about Latter-day Saints, black, and race. But as I said earlier, I just want to share a little with you and remember, I'm talking about me and why I joined the church and what enticed me to join the church. And what I'd like to do is start by briefly sharing some of my history, where I came from and how I got here, which kind of give you an idea of where I was before I joined the church and then the transition from where I was to joining the church. I grew up in a little small black community in Prince George's County. It was called Cedar Heights, a little small community. We had about an 8-foot barbed wire fence that separated us from the white community. And my whole life was black then. This was back in the 50s and 60s. The church was black, all my friends were black. But believe it or not, but race during that time never really played an issue for us. We were never really exposed to the outside world in that little community. And the more I remember, it's more like a self-contained village. We were not taught to hate others because the color of their skin, for the color of their skin, or for any reason. I just enjoyed life, and none of that kind of stuff really entered my mind. But in 1962, it's a long time ago, I graduated from high school and I joined the Navy. And that was my first exposure to the outside world. Matter of fact, I was so naive that when I was discriminated against when I was in uniform, I didn't even know it. I was on a special assignment, and we were over in Ocean City, Maryland, and we went to this restaurant to get something to eat, and I had three other white sailors with me, and we ordered our food, and the waitress took our food. She went to the back, and then she came back, and she said, "Well, I can fill this order, but you can't eat it here." So I'm looking. I said, "Well, why? You know, I can." And then the light came on because I was black. And I was in uniform. I raised my hand to the square and said, "I served this country." But on Ocean City in 1962, I couldn't eat in those restaurants. But my tour in the Navy was also, like I said, my first experience with civil rights. I can remember like it was yesterday. The scenes from the South that I saw on television. A young 18-year-old coming from a black community. It's amazing to think that I grew up and never really saw what was going on in the South. Never really saw what was going on in this country in terms of that clash, that racism that was going on. But I watched the civil rights, and I was watching TV this day. I saw the civil rights marchers and they were being attacked by white policemen with electric cattle prods and billy clubs, fire hoses, canine dogs. And again, I was just 18 years old. And I was really struggling with how to deal with racism in my own mind. And then I started reading about Malcolm X and the Black Panthers. And I started reading about Martin Luther King, you know. So I'm a young black, you know, fresh out of a community that, like, you know, when you come from Utah and you see the real world, you know. It's almost like that, you know. And that's the way I felt. You know, and that sounded good, and Panthers and a lot of confrontational stuff there, that sounded good. And then with Martin Luther King saying, you know, be nonviolent, let them spit on you, and let them sick dogs on you, and cattle prods, and you know, I just didn't think like that then. I was real radical. I wanted confrontation. And each had a different approach to how to solve the problem. And you know, I was pretty bitter after seeing the carnage that was going on in the South and the legal justification supporting the actions of the white police officers. And then, like I said, Malcolm and the Black Panther began to sound good. However, I began to read more about Martin Luther King and the philosophy of nonviolence. But I was still having difficulty dealing with the type of passive response to the violent actions in the South. But all that changed on my birthday, August the 28th, 1963, with the March on Washington and the I Had a Dream speech by Dr. King. And as I said, I was stationed in Washington during that time. And during the march, I know you guys are kind of young, but during the march, 200 people came to Washington, and they were at the Lincoln Memorial. So you can just imagine that, you know, being that close to the White House, You know what a mosque was, right? So the White House is only about 200, 300 yards away. So our job in the Navy was, if a riot broke out, that we had to do riot control. So some of the training was, you know, we had to use bayonets, we had to use tear gas, you know, whatever it took. We were guarding this one bridge, 11th Street Bridge, which is over there near where the Nationals baseball team plays, and we were to let anybody out but nobody in if a riot broke out. And nobody knew at the time that all those government buildings that were surrounding Washington and the monument and all that, they were filled with military people. But we didn't want to show that kind of force to the marchers. And luckily, nothing happened. But let me share one thing that happened. The night before the march, about 10 black American sailors, we got together and we said, you know, these people are coming to Washington and they're marching for our freedoms. So are we going to go out there with bayonets and tear gas and do these things? So we decided quietly that if a riot breaks out, that we would lay our weapons down and do nothing. That's not good, because we just raised our hands to the square and said we serve America. But luckily, no riots broke out, and our young, you know, our youthfulness didn't really hurt us, because, you know, probably I wouldn't be standing here today. I probably have dishonorable discharge, treason, whatever. But that's the kind of stuff that was going on in our minds. Now, luckily, nothing happens. Now, I'm just trying to give you a feel for what was going on in Winston back in the 60s. Now, for the remainder of the 1960s, I was involved in somewhat of a nonviolent way with the civil rights movement. Although I was on the front line, I kind of voiced my opinion, very active in college at Morgan and at Howard. And there are many other stories I probably could share with you tonight regarding the civil rights movements and my coming of age during this challenging and growing time. But tonight I just wanted to share these past experiences, give you a sense of the time that I grew up and the events that shaped my life that made me the person that I am today. And I want you to know that I had great parents who taught me how to live during those times in a dignified manner and to better myself regardless of the circumstances that I confronted. And never to blame anyone for the circumstances that existed. Now, moving on, after graduating from law school in 1974, I began to really focus on beginning a family and getting started in the world of work, like you guys are going to have to do soon. And I became more introspective about myself. You know, I had a friend in law school who told me in order to be a complete person, I had to be mentally, physically, and spiritually strong. I had just lost my mother in 1974 and my father in 1975. And that both had a profound impact on my life. So for the next 4 years, I was struggling, trying to find out who I was, or how I really fit into the world, really philosophical. And at this point, I began to ask myself questions. I said, what is this really all about? How much control do I have over my own destiny? Where did I come from? Is there really a God? Will I pass the Maryland bar exam? I mean, all these questions were really coming in my mind, and I was trying to get some answers. But at this point, I really began to seriously think about those issues, mentally, physically, and spiritually strong. I began to think about church and the spiritual aspect of my life. I was raised a Methodist, but was not finding any spiritual satisfaction. My wife was staunch Baptist, and we both started looking for other churches. We attended Catholic, Lutheran, but we decided on joining the Islamic faith. I became a Muslim. My name was Wahid Muhammad Ahmadi. And we attended the mosque up on Connecticut Avenue in Washington, D.C. And I had my prayer rug. I'm praying five times a day. My wife didn't like it because in the mosque, you know, the men were lined up shoulder to shoulder and the women had to be along the wall. And they couldn't say anything, which I liked. But she didn't like that. Oh, no. I don't mean to sound fit. No. That was a joke, ladies. That was a joke. Okay. And we did that for about 5 years. And, you know, I was still asking myself, but even with the Muslim faith, I didn't get that spiritual satisfaction I talked about earlier. So I was still praying about it. So one weekend, I was in Ocean City again. Same Ocean City that wouldn't let me eat. I was in Ocean City again at a political function. And I was walking down the lobby, about 200 people in the lobby. And I walked past this guy, and something said, "That's this guy, what church you belong to?" Out of clear blue. I didn't know who this guy was. So I grabbed him, and he was startled. Because this was a Republican event, and I was the only brother there. So you know he was startled. So we talked, and then I found out that he was Mormon. And he invited my family and I to come by his home to learn more about his religion, which we did. And he had some people there, and the Mormons can tell you, they teach you some lessons, and the lessons sounded good. And but not to my wife, though, because my wife said, "Are there any white people in this church?" And he said, "Yeah, there are white people in this church. On your first visit to the chapel, we're going to take you to sacrament, and you're going to see them." So, but lo and behold, this one Sunday, none of them showed up. So she had a little hesitation about joining the church, but I didn't. There was some answers that I raised before about who I was, the way I came from, where I'm going, what's going to happen in the end. I mean, all those questions for me were somewhat answered that night. So my puzzle came together, but hers didn't. So she was still wondering, So I didn't go there, But she eventually joined the church, and we joined the church together. This whole concept of understanding who I was, and like I said, where I was going, how I was going to get there, it just began to make sense to me. But now, after we joined, a year later, we joined in 1981. A year later, we heard in 1978, blacks couldn't hold the priesthood. But for us, if we heard that the night that we went by his house, we might ask more questions. I'm sure my wife would ask more questions, but we didn't hear that, So it was a year later, and about a year later, by that time, our faith in the church was strong, and we knew the church, this church, was true. I prayed, and I was led to this church. I didn't get that same feeling. We went to the Methodist and the Baptist and the Catholic, but I got a feeling for this church. So it didn't the concept of what happened, we didn't bother us. So, I think individual prayer was the strength for me back then. So, here I am tonight, standing before you, speaking on the issue of race and Mormonism. Now, I know many of you out there are still thinking, I hear what you're saying, but how could a brother who came through the civil rights movement and all of that stuff join this white church? I mean, that all sounds good. But like I said, it was for me. I tell my friends the same thing, it was for me. And it was because of my prayer and my internal fortitude, and it solved my problems. And the man, I solved my friends' problems. I even got two kids, and they're not members, but it doesn't solve their problem. Hopefully, one day it will. Now, I know you've read and heard many accounts about the LDS Church and the accusations of its past racial policy that limited African-American access to the priesthood. Now, I'm not here tonight to pass judgment, but I just want to give you my personal perspective of why I joined the church. Normally, what I just told you was somewhat of what we call a conversion story, and I would normally stop there. But here's my understanding of the issue. And Bill talked about this. Now, from the mid-1800s to 1978, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints generally banned black male members from holding the priesthood and from serving missions and participating in temple work. Now, although there is some recorded history that blacks were ordained to the priesthood in the mid-1800s, but for the most part, blacks were denied the priesthood. And as Bill said, this practice was nullified in 1978 by then Church President Spencer W. Kimball. And he received a clarifying revelation that extended the priesthood and temple blessings to all worthy members of the church. Now, although the practice has been discontinued, issues of equality and race continue to surface regarding the church. And the issue was most recently surfaced during when Mitt Romney ran for the U.S. presidency. There were some questions about blacks in the priesthood in his campaign. And as Bill said, most church members, when confronted with this issue, are ill-prepared to answer or at a loss to say or what to say about this. And I've heard many reasons given. Bill gave some. Some don't understand the issues. Some don't believe racism is an issue. Some have never experienced racism. Some fear that discussing racism or equality might unnecessarily stir up old wounds. Some fear that by discussing it, they might offend others. And some just don't want to call attention to the differences. There have been ongoing attempts to change the mindset of a lot of church members on how they view this issue. DVDs have been produced to address the myth regarding the scripture references to skin colors in some of the Mormon scripture. And there's been an ongoing push to get the church to actually apologize for the ban. Now, so where does my perspective fall on all of this? In a sense, I've kind of already given it to you when I said that I know the church is true. That's where I fall on this. I know it's true because I prayed about it. And I said I got an answer that I didn't get from all the other churches. Now, what I'm sharing with you tonight is a personal perspective of Winston Wilkinson. Remember earlier I talked about my search in civil rights days, and I looked at Malcolm X, I looked at the Black Panthers, and I finally decided that Martin Luther King's approach really fit what I was looking for. And to be honest with you, I'm the type of person, once I answered those questions for me, about who I was and where I'm going and how I'm going to get there, I just move on in life to other challenges. I don't dwell on that. I mean, there's some members in the church, blacks, that they still fighting that battle back there. Some still fighting the slavery battle. But at some point, you got to move forward. Now, I know that happened for me. I teach my kids this. I mean, you kind of solve what you can solve and what you can have control over, and that's what I did with this. You know, I personal perspective. I found myself in this church solve those questions for me. Now, we can debate the issues on and on, and hopefully you have some questions that you want to raise about this. And you know what? A lot of people still look at me a little strange when they hear I'm Mormon and Republican, especially now. I don't want to digress, but people say, how can you be a Republican and a Mormon, man? How is that possible? But you know what? I guess my father was different, even when I was growing up. You know, and I make my decision. I'm not swayed by a lot of emotions, but you know, just like in law school, they said, I don't know if they still use this principle, but it's like, is it Iraq? That's still around? Issue rules and application, and that's how I live my life. I mean, no, take that with you, because you got to solve those problems in life. Iraq is going to follow you all the way through life. And then you can, no, seriously. And then you can clearly deal with issues. And that's what I did. And a lot of people still ask me that question. You know, I'm not going to tell you who I'm voting for president. Got two great candidates, but it's the same issue with being a Republican. It really is. You know, how can you be a Republican, man? So it's challenging. But like, it's my perspective, it's who I am, I'm at peace with myself. And you know what? Let me read this. I would have been in big spiritual trouble if I let the discussion on race and the priesthood keep me from joining this church. Think about that. For me, I would have been in big trouble. And, you know, you guys are young. A lot of you are young and still dealing with those issues. And, you know, when I was your age, like I tell you, I finished law school and then started my family right after. You know, and the real life came in. And at some point, you know, you're going to deal with that spiritual aspect. You know, you might not think about it now, because, you know, you're strong and you think, you know, everything you're doing on your own. But at some point, you will. And it, and when I began to ask myself, you know, in order to be a full, whole person, you know, I was running, and so I was physically in shape, and went to law school, and mentally in shape. But then at some point, you are going to have to, if you haven't, but you will. It'll loom larger in your life, the whole spiritual aspect. But that's why I joined the church. Even though I came through that civil rights period, and I'm a, you know, successful African American living in Utah, Mormon, Republican. That's a mouthful, isn't it? But I say, I'm really at peace with myself. But tonight, I try to answer those questions that you might want to ask. You know, I kind of glossed over this thing because this is a big issue, you know, and it's ongoing. I don't talk about it a lot. You know, some oldest coming down here. You know, I talk to my kids, people who are willing to listen. Since you're a captive audience, you have to listen. But normally, I don't. You know, be asked me to come down. I thought it'd be great to come down and share some thoughts, because I spend a lot of time with oldies and we talk and you know, whatever wisdom I have over the years, I try to share it with him. But the whole spiritual aspect is interesting. This is for all you non-Mormons. This is not missionary work. I mean, we're not trying to get you to join the church or anything. But you know, I think what Bill is saying, you know, the idea of getting Bassa and people of Mormon faith or whatever to come together, you know, for brotherhood, and because it's not all about race. It's really not. And the idea to be open and to be able to discuss it and talk about it, I think is great. I think it's great for y'all to do this and to be able to come together and talk and share thoughts and deep feelings and be open about it. So if you got questions, be open about it. Some deep seated feelings you had about the church, or we'll try to answer those tonight. But anyway, that's all. Am I early, Bill?
No, you're good. Mia, I think, has. If you guys want to pass your questions to the end of the rows, we'll get those.
Do you have a question?
I have a question.
Okay.
Well, as people are filling out cards, I would like to first thank Wilson for coming in on behalf of Rels and Balsa. I know that personally this is a huge accomplishment for me. This is an event that Bill and I have been talking about since, I think, our first year in law school. You know, I'm a city girl from Baltimore, and I'm like, you know, I've never met anybody from Oklahoma. And I mean, it started with, you know, small discussions about what it means to be a minority in this country and what it means, you know, to be an African American or what it means to be a Mormon, and how, as times are changing, the definition of minority is changing. And for me, I think that has a lot, you know, to do with our current political environment, given the election and just the world around us. So this is something that I was really looking forward to, simply to have an open dialogue with people of other backgrounds. So if anyone has questions that they'd like to ask right now, the floor is open. If not, we will go to the cards. So please don't be shy. No one has something to give up to say.
Awesome. Thank you. I was writing this out. It's just taking forever. I guess I'm Nick Nelson. I'm 2L here at UVA. I'm a woman. It sounds like a confession. I guess what I was going to ask is, in the church, there's not a big emphasis on race. You don't hear from the elders of the church that the black members need to get along with the white members need to reach out to the black members. It's more they talk about church membership as a whole, and I think it has a unifying effect. I mean, I presume every once in a while there are, like Bill Quote of President Hinckley is saying, you know, racism is just not to be tolerated. But there is, I don't think, as members of the church generally, we think of ourselves along those lines as kind of, you know, maybe member or not, but not like them. And I guess I've thought of that as a positive approach to kind of racial issues, kind of maybe not emphasizing the differences. But I know that there are obviously limitations. There are certain things that you need to address and kind of get out in the open and talk about. I just wondered if you have any thoughts on sort of that as a policy as opposed to kind of a more confrontational policy of let's address this head on. That's it. You can see why I was thinking
about that. Well, I think the church is, I would agree with the church policy, you know, because I don't think the confrontational approach works. But I think just the natural tendency of people, you know, it's hard being black, you know, because there's certain things, like an issue might come up and you might see it, but for blacks, because, you know, we harbor so much, I mean, the history, and so even though I know the Mormon church has a history, that same struggle, but it's more of a deep-seated history with blacks, you know, and when things come up, you know, like I might react to something and say, well, you know, what's Winston's problem, you know, but sometimes those things happen, and What happened over the years for me is I had to categorize and pick a place in my brain to put a lot of stuff. And as long as I keep that closed, I'm okay. But now if something comes up, and all of a sudden that opens, you know, and then you might see something in Winston or, you know. But that always happens. That's human nature, you know. So I think the church policy is correct, but, you know, like I said, people harbor a lot of history. So I don't think it'll always be smooth sailing. That's why a lot of members, you know, still challenging the church should apologize for the past. And even when we celebrated it, we celebrated the ban and lifting of the ban. I mean, there were still some who wanted to take it further, you know, so it's going to be tough. But I think for the most part, the church does a good job. And like President Hinckley always said, you know, the past is the past, and let's move forward. I think that we should move forward. That's my philosophy. As I said earlier, I believe in moving forward. I hope that answered.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes.
Also Mormon. Actually, I was a missionary in Guatemala, and I noticed a lot of the times when when groups of missionaries would get together, the Native Central American missionaries and the Gringo missionaries would kind of end up in little pods without anybody ever actually trying to, I don't think anybody ever consciously did it. It just ended up, you know, people would sort of know more about cultures and kind of know each other better. And there seems to be, unfortunately, you know, a lot of times people just sort of gravitate to those they know a little bit better. And I'm wondering how you, combat that a little bit, because I think,
you know,
the more the groups mix, the better off.
I don't know about combating it. I think there's an assimilation issue. But, you know, in Utah, you know, we have it's a group called Genesis, and that it's a black group, and they meet every first Sunday. And, socializing, I think that's good, because like Bill was saying, you know, because we've got so many different wards and people don't really get to see each other. So from a social aspect, I think that's good. You know, that's worked in Salt Lake. So I can understand. And I know you need complete assimilation, but sometimes it's good to socialize with I can say what you own, but but yeah, I don't see anything wrong with that. Yeah. Yes.
Oh no.
Oh, you have non-Mormon. Okay.
Well, I have a very good friend, a black guy who has converted to the Mormon Church. Within about 2 years, he, I don't know what it's called, the title, but it was either selected as an elder or mm-hmm. a priest, or selected for the priesthood. And there was a pretty big discussion among our group of friends, himself included, about whether or not he was selected and targeted because he was black. There's a lot of discontent and kind of a lot of bad feelings about it. Is that an issue that the Mormon Church is pursuing black members, or is it just pursuing everyone and everyone like any other church would do?
You mean to join?
To be selected for priesthood or for an elder status.
I think there's in the church, you know, that after a period of time you're in the church, then and you become an elder. Everybody becomes, you know, a certain age, and you know, you just become an elder. There's no selection process.
Okay.
So when I joined the church, you know, I think it was when you went 18, yeah. Everybody becomes an elder, regardless of color, you know, it's not
the
color.
18.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes. Love that brother. Regardless of color, I mean, Barack should be running for presidency, like Martin said, because of the content of his character, not the color of his skin. But a difficult challenge in America because of the history, and you know. So, no, I think we should love our brothers because they're brothers, regardless, and not because of the color of his skin. Yes.
I'm Alex, and I'm the Vice President of Boston. Thank you very much for coming this evening. I guess my question is, how did you decide to join the Republican Party, and do you find there's a relationship between your political beliefs and your religious beliefs? Or?
Well, what happened was, about 30 years ago, someone said, that's the party of the rich, so I ran over this. No. That's not true. No, I looked at the ideology of both parties, and I'm more of a free market type person, capitalist type, and just some of the values and principles in the Republican Party just fit my core value belief, you know. And you understand the role of government, that's a whole different speech, but the role of government and all that kind of stuff, and I just felt that, you know, not limited, efficient government. But it's more of an ideological thing. And just, again, like I joined the church, it just kind of made sense to me.
Well, I do have a question. This person has said, I'm asking you as the director of civil rights, so you've made that qualification. What are your feelings about affirmative action?
Ooh.
It might have been a setup.
I believe in affirmative action. As a tactic, when I was in law school, you know, we had some dealing with the administration. So one of the things we did was we shut the law school down. We chained all the doors and chained the dean out, so the dean couldn't get in. And as a tactic, it worked for a while until she went and got a TRO and made us take the chain off. So a tactic can work, but for so long, and I think affirmative action has worked. I'm not saying it's a level playing field. But we got to a point where we can rely less on it and more on the brains that we have here and the, you know, the opportunities we have here. But there's still a role for it. But I'm saying it's a lesser role. When I talk to my kid, you know, when they were young, it was hard for me to say, well, you know, you should get a bigger step in this game than the little white kid standing there. You know, but they should. But it's a concept that I think, a tactic, like I was saying about the law school, that has worked for a while now. We got to kind of move on. Keeping in mind that there are problems out there. There are racial problems, and they're more covert now than when I grew up. They were overt when I grew up. Then they're covert, and they're very hard to see. But there's a need for affirmative action.
Another question is, why has Mormonism not caught on in the black communities? And I guess I'll make this qualification. I guess this person is referring to the U.S. or I'll ask you to look at your answer to the U.S. and then you can deal with the international.
But it has caught on. You know, it's growing. It's growing. It's just, you know. I mean, the church keeps statistics, but they don't necessarily, they're not broken down into black, white, you know. And right now, I think the growth of the church is more outside the U.S. than inside. So, they're probably more non-white than white, if you look at it worldwide. But, you know, they are growing. They're growing. People look at me and I say, some from Utah, they look at me, they got blacks in Utah? Sure, they got blacks in Utah. You know, but there are blacks in the church.
And the follow-up question is, is racism still prominent among Mormons who live during the ban?
Wait a minute, ask that again?
Is racism still prominent among Mormons who live during the ban? So I guess the question is asking whether or not there's a generational difference in issues of race among the church.
That's a good question. I think there are some people in the church who believe, when you read about this, and I encourage you to Google it, it's a lot out there, and you get a good understanding. There are some feelings about some older members of the church saying why blacks couldn't hold a priesthood, and they got very strong feelings about that. And I won't get into them, but they're out there. There is some, yeah.
You too.
Yeah.
Another question is there any truth to the story that the LDS church was in danger of losing their religious tax exempt status when they accepted blacks as priests?
No.
Some of the things you've touched on. Here's a very good one. I think you've touched on this before, but this person, I guess, without you telling us, very straightforward. Do you believe the church should apologize? Why?
Nothing. The church should apologize? No.
Why?
Well, because like I told you, things happened in the past for whatever reason. Slavery happened for whatever reason. I don't think that's going to change anything. I mean, will it make me as a black feel good because America apologized for slavery? No, not me. Because the church held back the priesthood? No, I think, Nelson Mandela was asked a question, did he hate his jailers? And he said, no, he said, if I still hated him, I'd still be in jail mentally. So at some point, you got to move on. And that's my philosophy, and I believe that Mandela was on the right track, that you got to let it go.
Elijah Abel, black man, was given the priesthood during the time of Joseph Smith. When Smith found out, he let the ordination stand. Why?
Say that one more time.
Because Elijah Abel, a black man, was given a priesthood during the time of Joseph Smith. When Smith found out, he let the ordination stand. Why?
He let it stand?
And how does this fit within the practice of not ordaining other blacks to the priesthood, which was the practice of the day? So why would he make the exception for this man?
That's a good question. Where's Bill?
So Elijah Abel, there is a record of a man named Elijah Abel having been ordained to the priesthood and holding office of 70, actually, which is a higher office than elder, during the presidency of Joseph Smith. It looks like the practice of not allowing African Americans to hold the priesthood didn't really start in force and didn't become ubiquitous in the church until after Joseph Smith's death. So there are records of a couple of black priesthood holders, a small handful, of course. There just weren't a lot of African-American members of the church during that early period, but there were a few before Brigham Young's day.
Okay. Do you have a question?
Yeah, I actually have a question.
question. I just walked in, so I don't know if this has been answered, but I was watching a 60-minute special that was to be aired from several years ago, and they were talking about how the church wanted to increase to sort of other countries and sort of like lifting up the ban and sort of extending out to other sort of, you know, more non-white areas as a way to sort of, because the numbers are going down apparently, and sort of as a way to sort of increase membership in the church. I wanted you to talk about that. And this is just an allegation or something that the reporter brought up.
Numbers were going down.
it was basically saying the point of, you know, removing the ban or, you know, increasing presence in other countries was to increase membership within the church because, you know,
I don't think that's true. I mean, you know, I mean, we got about 50,000 missionaries out there now. I think the missionary zeal in the church had nothing to do with the band.
In other words, it was a missionary thing, not a political thing.
It wasn't political.
Yeah, no, it wasn't political.
No. Am I asking your question?
I mean, I'm not sure. Well, yeah, it was basically like they felt like, you know, people want, I don't know, really, sort of to re-energize the church, and so that was sort of my emphasis behind, you know, because, I mean, did they always go to other countries from the very start? Was that always something that was part of the church, or?
Oh, yeah, from the beginning.
Okay.
I think the first converts came from across the waters. No, I don't think there's no political motivation, but by, you know, by reaching out to other races, or no. It wasn't a numbers game. Never a numbers game.
There's, I think you've touched upon this, and sometimes I'd like you to reiterate this, but how does your family feel about you and your wife joining the church?
Oh, my in-law said, you know, well, I'm going to tell you a story. When My mother-in-law thinks I'm crazy. Let's start off, you know, there's one point I brought my wife home and she had her head all wrapped up and she was a Muslim and my mother-in-law looked at her and said, and the next thing I brought her home, she was Mormon. And she said, what are you doing to my daughter? And then we moved to Utah, you know, so, my mother-in-law's coming around. You know, people tend to, you know, they say, well, Winston's kind of been all over the place, and you know, so they watch me and say, well, how serious is he about this? So then once they watch me, and it's been almost 27 years, and they see that I'm serious, and that, you know, this church is not all that bad. And the more we talk about it, and the more some of the myth are gone. I mean, people still think that not gonna have another wife, which might be appealing though. Well, we can't. That's a joke. But those things don't happen. I mean, as lawyers, you know that in 1890 something, polygamy was outlawed. I forget the case. Reynolds. It was a case outlawed, that kind of stuff, you know. But no, once my family, they like everybody else, they had these misconceived notions about Mormons and all that, and over the years. So, in answer to your question, I'm accepted by all the members of my family now. Yes.
Quick one. You said for yourself personally, prayer was kind of how you came to terms with the, you know, the ban being lifted and things. Is that the same thing you suggest for other people that struggle with this issue? The prayer. Is there any other resource?
You know, I do because when, you know, even in the church, you know, when the missionaries are out working and they run across other blacks and they raise this issue about, well, what about blacks in the priesthood? So they bring them to me because I've been in the church for years and say, well, let Brother Wilkinson answer that. I said, well, I can't answer that. You have to answer that on your own testimony and on your own faith and your own belief. I mean, you can't answer it on my belief. It has to be on your belief. So I won't quote scripture, but there's a 10-4 more on that, you know, but you have to, you know, it has to be on the strength of your own faith and your own testimony.
Students, as we know them as. So please, if you'd like to make your way that way, greatly appreciated. Thank you again for coming once again on behalf of Rounds and Tulsa. Thank you for being with you this evening.
Thank you for your patience. Bill, this is the money, you want to pass this around?
Yeah.